to the Vagina Testimonies. I'm Cheryl Bruno. I'd like to ask you all to turn off your mobile devices as we get started. Good, Holly's coming in. Come on, come right up here, Holly.
I don't have to go now.
No, you don't have to go now. This session will be divided into two hours. The first hour long, we have the panelists that you see up sitting here before you, and we will take a short break following their remarks, and then I hope you'll join us for also the second session that we're going to also have some great continuation of what we're doing. The Vagina Monologue started out with Eve Ensler, as you can see in your program, who did a series of monologues and has continued those on for many years. And 10 years ago, a group of Mormon women decided to get together and do the Mormon Vagina Monologues. We have some people in our audience who were there for that. And so that was quite an exciting time, and this is like a 10-year, actually 11-year anniversary. We're doing it again, and I think we've maybe changed a little bit, hopefully progressed a little bit in our feelings towards Mormons and sexuality. So we'll see how that goes. Today we're going to be hearing from Catherine Allred, who's a stay-at-home amateur trombonist, knitter, motorcyclist, and unemployed librarian. Donna Banta, who has published her first novel, A Murder Mystery. Is it downstairs for sale?
Yeah.
Yay, okay, you can see the her murder mystery downstairs. The Girls from the Fourth Ward. Marie Davis Bryan has an alternate persona known as the Cotton Floozy.
She
might be here.
She will be here, but later. She's the one who's
okay.
Corsage.
Okay, well, that's why we don't have our corsages. All right. Then we have Hillary Brown, who is an emerging poetess and writer here, grew up in Sugar City, Idaho, and is now here in Salt Lake City, plans to finish a bachelor degree at the University of Utah. Following their remarks, I will say a few things, and then I'd like to invite the audience to come up and give us comments. You don't have to ask a question. You can just make your own comments. Carol, sorry, that was not very nice. Carol is my good friend. She also has a novel downstairs, which I have read and I can thoroughly recommend, called Ex-Mormon. She blogs at Main Street Plaza, and she is a wonderful person, so 40 lashes to me for not introducing her. And we will go ahead and start with Catherine.
Didn't know I was going first. This is just like being back in church. A little uncomfortably so. And I also didn't know I was going first, but what the hell. I am pleased to own a vulva, or as it's referred to here, a vagina. Forgive me if I speak too fast, it's a bad habit of mine. So, my vagina. All of it is amazing. I get enormous pleasure from it, and I give enormous pleasure with it. But it took me a very long time to get here. More like sacrament meeting than I remember. I didn't know this was going to happen. For the first 18 years of my life, I hated my vulva because it did not belong to me. It belonged to him. I had to literally tell him that he did not own me and that I did not owe him before I could own it, before I could love it. He would wait until my mother was at an evening church activity or sick, or hospitalized in labor, or one time having a tumor removed, and then he would make sure that I knew exactly how much I did not own any part of my body, particularly my most private parts. He had the priesthood, he explained more than once, and therefore Heavenly Father had given him complete dominion over me. It was his God-anointed duty to exercise that dominion in order to teach me obedience. In a way, I suppose I have him in part to thank for my happy liberation from the Mormon Church. I remember when, as a teenager, I heard a member of my ward bishopric, a man I loved, a man from whom I had great respect and who was publicly well-esteemed, give a talk, later widely quoted, in which he read a scripture about love and then asked us to replace the word love with the word obedience, thus revealing, he told us, the verse's true meaning. It was then that I knew that this was no longer God's church, if ever it was. I already knew that obedience was obliteration. If obedience was the highest law of heaven, I wanted no part of that heaven. Because I didn't own my vulva, I was unable to say no to the boyfriend who told me to give him access to it if I wanted him to stay with me. I knew at the time that it was another form of self-obliteration. But having already been betrayed by a righteous protector, I felt in my soul that I was doomed and had no choice. It was the guy after that who unwittingly set me on the path to self-redemption. He claimed to be a feminist, had all the women's studies textbooks on his shelf, and was really good at talking the talk. It made it all the more confusing when I went to break up with him that he took the opportunity to disregard the three times I said no, pushing me down and doing to me what he wanted to do. After working with a few psychologists, two of whom administered priesthood blessings as a regular part of treatment, leaving me further traumatized by patriarchalism, that I realized that what had happened to me as a child wasn't my fault, that depressingly common sentiment among those who have experienced abuse. I told my abuser that I was no longer his property, and that I did not, despite his assertion to the contrary, owe him anything. It was something he was able to understand based only on his concept that I was married by then and therefore belonged to my husband. I recognize that he is to some degree a product of his culture. It is healing and powerful to reject that culture for myself. He denies now that anything ever happened. When I first spoke to him about it as an adult, his response was, I don't remember doing that. And later it became, I'm sorry that you feel the need to talk about this. If you asked my vulva and someone did, or I wouldn't be up here, it would say that choice is the highest law of heaven. The power to choose. The power to say, yes, I will, or no, I won't. The power to say, touch me like this. The power to say, you may never touch me. It is the power to fight, the power to embrace. It is the power to change what is. It took too long to learn that that power is mine. It's harder to describe an evolutionary process than to show the before and after. Suffice it to say that it is still happening today. But at least I know at last that my vagina is mine, and I like it a great deal. It pulsates and changes, and it calls for a lovely ritual of care. It has its own wardrobe of delightful things in which to dress it. It orgasms, bathing me in a sea of endorphined bliss. It stretches enough to push babies through it. It's taken me a long time to become this happy with it, but I am. Modern culture, we know, tells us that we are not enough in our raw, unpowdered, unbuttressed forms. But that is a lie. I am happy with my body. I am happy with myself. This is my vagina, and it does what it wants.
Vagina. Do you mind? Is that?
Yeah, I think you need to say that a little louder.
Point. I have a vagina. I have a womb. I am the sacred feminine. My holy female cycle keeps me in tune with God by way of heavenly mood swings and hot flashes of inspiration. I am the stronger sex. It is a heavy mantle to bear. Every day brings new challenges, especially in these troubled times, when increasing numbers seek to challenge our God-given authority, even here in Zion. For example, yesterday I awoke, dressed, and came downstairs. My helpmeet, Mark, served breakfast, just the usual. Eggs, bacon, waffles, homemade banana muffins for me, half a grapefruit for him. I appreciate that Mark works at keeping his figure. I kissed him goodbye and rushed to an important leadership meeting on the BYU campus, 9 o'clock sharp. I gathered around a well-lacquered conference table with my fellow sisters to take on some tough issues. First on the agenda, a sensitively worded statement to be read to all LDS wards and stakes, one that tactfully marginalizes all members who are not white, straight, married, with at least 5 kids, living on one income and fulfilling their gender-specific roles. Second on the agenda, a hip PR campaign that only features members who do not fit the above profile. Afterward, my colleagues and I headed towards across campus for some good old gal talk at the Sisterhood Bakery. I marveled at the many righteous young women I passed along the way, but I was shocked by the rebelliousness of some of the young men. First, I spotted a rather homely young man holding up a placard that read, "It's my sperm." I chalked this up to his obvious inability to get a date. Then a few minutes later, another shouted, "No fair! Why can't men eat at the Sisterhood Bakery?" I drew a breath, mustered all of my patience, and said, "Young man, in the unlikely event that the Lord allows men to hold the keys to the Sisterhood Bakery, which cookie would you want?" After lunch, I headed to the library, hoping to do some research. Unfortunately, I found it impossible to concentrate, thanks to a shockingly immodest young man in a pair of Levi's 501 shrink-to-fit jeans. Now, you may ask, don't lots of boys at BYU wear 501 shrink-to-fits? Perhaps, but this particular young man had an especially curvy backside that strained the confines of his tightly shrunk pants. Then when he turned toward me, I was confronted by his well-defined, bulging, and enormous maleness. Hot, sweaty, and breathless, I quit the building. Now, this is difficult to explain to somebody who only has a penis. But you see, God designed the penis for a single purpose: the impregnating of the holy female womb, an act that is efficient, perfunctory, and complete inside of a minute. The vagina, on the other hand, has that sacred spot that God created specifically for pleasure and nothing else. It alone is comprised of 8,000 nerve fibers. The measly penis, on the other hand, is equipped with only 4,000. So by nature, men have no concept of the dangerous power of the female orgasm. Once aroused, a woman's passion gathers, builds, swells with quivering anticipation, and finally peaks in hot, wet waves of erotic pleasure that drives her to a prolonged climax of nonstop frenzied desire. Even then, she may not be sated and can achieve orgasm again and again for an hour upon hour with no end in sight. That young man in the 501s had no idea how lucky he was. If I hadn't gotten the courage to leave when I did, I might have lost control, thrown him on the ground, and had my way with him. And it would have been entirely his fault. I rushed home to find my helpmeet Mark alone at his craft table, hot gluing felt for an upcoming Elder's Quorum lesson. I seized him. "I have to have you now. Well, can I at least finish my felt?" "Screw the felt." "Okay, please be gentle." 4 hours later, I left Mark collapsed in a puddle of hot glue and headed out to my office at the church. I had only one appointment, but it turned out to be a lengthy one. Sven, a young swimsuit model, had taken a job for a prescription drug company. It was one of those ads promoting the custom-fit vaginal vibrators that are covered by insurance. The commercial featured Sven in a swimming pool surrounded by some perimenopausal women. When the shoot was over, the women predictably lost control and forced Sven to perform oral sex on all 6 of them. Wait, or was it 7? Just to be safe, I had him repeat the whole story. It was 6 women in the pool. Or was it the hot tub? I better have him back. Finally, I went home, retired to my bed, and drifted off to sleep, thinking of all the privileges I am entitled to simply because of the anatomy inside of my underpants. And more importantly, I wondered how much longer I would get to be on top.
Temple, and I want to welcome you to the celestial room. You will not take out endowments here. You don't have to be endowed at all to be here. I only wish to bring you to glory. You may not find fulfillment. You may only find frustration. You may not find God, or you may find the devil. You may find a bruised heel and a crushed head. It doesn't have to be spiritual. It doesn't have to be thoughtful. It doesn't have to be holy. It can be carnal and lustful and of the flesh. We will be naked. We will be unashamed. For this is my work, and this is my glory. Thank you.
Chewed gum or licked cupcakes. And I never did, even at my most Mormon. Mormon kids learn some very interesting lessons about sex. For one thing, they learn that doing it is a sin next to murder, and that even thinking about it, even wanting to do it and imagining it, is almost as bad as actually doing it. Girls get the additional message that sex somehow uses them up, that the act of sexual intercourse somehow transforms them from being a pristine, fresh out of the wrapper stick of gum, to being a wad of chewed up gum, or from being a pretty, fresh cupcake to being a slobbery, disgusting cupcake with all the delicious frosting licked off. I totally believed and internalized the first message, that feeling lust means that you're an unspeakably shameful sinner, and I spent many years as a kid cowering in the closet of shame for the crime of entertaining the occasional sexual fantasy and enjoying it, instead of putting up other actors on my mental stage, as we're taught that the righteous and holy people are supposed to be able to do. I never bought into the other message, though. I'm not a cupcake at all, licked or otherwise. I'm a person. Any guy who would seriously consider the hermetic seal on my vagina and the ignorance that that seal implies to be an important part of what makes me a good partner for love or marriage, screw him. He's an idiot. That's great that he doesn't want to marry me, because the feeling is very mutual. I know a lot of women consider an invitation into that sacred space to be one of the most profound gifts that they can give. Allowing another flesh to enter your body is, for some, an almost life-altering big deal. And as I've listened to other women's stories, I've come to understand that isn't entirely the result of bad lessons about chewed gum and licked cupcakes, that we have our own different experiences and different perspectives. However, for myself, I always felt empowered by my natural inclination that it's not that big a deal. Sexual intercourse, and here I mean traditional vaginal penetration, can be a wonderful pleasure. It can be an expression of love, and in some circumstances, it can be something very bad. But it doesn't represent me handing over some essential part of myself to another person any more than a man is permanently diminished by giving me his essence, or whatever the metaphor would be if our social prejudices were reversed. By the time I entered BYU at age 17, I was convinced that the church's teachings on sexuality were totally wrong. I saw sex as something playful and fun, something that might be part of a relationship, but not necessarily. One of my freshman dorm mates from Budge Hall told me about a game she played in her naughtier days called I Never. Basically, a group of people sit around in a circle and take turns saying, I never did such and such. And then everyone who did such and such has to take a drink. It sounded amusing. And since most of these such and suches were obviously about sex, it kind of inspired me to make up my own game of trying to have sex in unusual places. In particular, I had sex with a boyfriend in the bathroom of the Harold B. Lee Library. True story. And with another in an annex of a BYU chemistry lab. Now, I know I'm admitting to have broken the honor code, and I have discussed this on my that decision on my blog. I don't want to get sidetracked by it here. Later locations included a cave, a boat, a stairwell, a bank vault to have safe sex. True story. And a convent, and probably some other places I don't remember.
Mile High Club?
No, not what I meant. Sorry. Yeah, still have time for me and my husband to do something fun. Anyway, and yet after all that, I never got around to playing. I never. That's your cue to take a drink. When dating, after I finished with BYU, I always made a point to have sex as early in a relationship as possible, generally on the first date. On my blog, I wrote a number of semi-serious reasons for this. For fun, for efficiency, for the element of surprise, and to weed out guys who disrespect sluts, or guys who didn't actually want to have sex with women for whatever reason. And it was also because I didn't like the dynamic I'd observed in chase dating relationships where sex is this giant elephant in the room, this relentlessly ever-present objective or anti-objective that places all other activities in the shadow of thinking about what you're not doing. I felt like it was better just to do it and have a clear head to relate to each other as humans while deciding whether the relationship is one you want to pursue. Today, my attitude hasn't substantially changed, even if my behavior looks quite different. I've been happily, monogamously married for more than 11 years. I choose to be monogamous, not because extramarital sex is a sin, but out of love and respect for my husband. And even if sex doesn't transform me, it's not totally devoid of emotional consequences that could affect our relationship. And my adorable sweetie is the only one I want to be with. And I hope that my example shows that a girl, regardless of what sexual experiences she may or may not have had, is not a cupcake or a stick of gum. I say these things in the name of all that is good and chooses not to be holy. Amen.
Testimony a couple years ago when Cheryl first gave me the idea for it. I was really excited about it. And I brought it up on my laptop this morning and I thought, oh wow, this is by far the gutsiest thing I've ever written. And that's coming from someone who's written a lot about a lot of gutsy subjects. And it's definitely going to be the gutsiest thing I've ever performed. But I would have to say, after watching Catherine speak, that was the most courageous and eloquent channeling of female pain I've ever witnessed. And I want to honor what you did here today, and I heard you, and I'm steeled by it. I'm steeled by you, woman. And so anyway, I think it was meant to be that we were on the same panel, if you believe in that sort of thing. And I do wish this microphone was higher. I'm going to try again. Okay. This is called A Mormon Vagina Dialogue. Conversation 1. Hey, down here. What the hell was that? Oh, by the way, I swear on this. We discussed this before, and Cheryl and I agreed that there are no boundaries in this panel. What? Where? It's me. Your vagina. What the hell, you can talk? Yes, I can. I've been trying to talk to you for a while. Okay. I'm seriously freaked out. What do you want? I want to talk to you about my needs. Do you have to say the word like that? Needs? You're embarrassing me. Sorry. Anyway, I'm not into that kind of thing. You know that. I haven't done that, and I don't do that. But you think about it. No, I don't. My mistake, I guess. That's right, your mistake. It isn't righteous. You think your body isn't righteous? Doing that kind of thing, it blackens your soul. My vagina laughed.
Who told you that? Inspired people, I said.
And why are you talking to me? You are not supposed to talk to me. You are supposed to just sit there quietly and do vagina-y things.
Like what?
Shut up, I said.
Conversation two.
Hey, down here. I can't talk right now. What do you want?
I'm just wondering when you're going to notice me again.
You? Never.
I'm never noticing you.
Never?
You can't be serious. I mean, I'm not until I'm married.
Well, hurry up and get married.
Okay, I'll try. White dresses, three-tiered cakes, cream chiffon.
Be quiet. I'm trying to think, and you're really distracting.
Green pillows, tulle netting, lattice backdrops.
Okay, I get the picture.
Pale green daisy-shaped mints and those little candy-covered almonds. Shut up, shut up, shut up. Conversation three.
Hey, down here.
What? Speak up, I can't hear you.
Hey, down here.
Why is your voice so soft?
Well, the rest of you might be 27 years old, but down here I'm an old woman.
Would you stop your complaining? I try to give you what you want and you're never happy.
You mean with him?
Don't start.
Everything could be so much simpler if you would listen.
It isn't his fault. It's this body. I don't even recognize it anymore. There's nothing wrong with your body, but there is something wrong with hating yourself, which is what you do.
Do you always have to be so mean? Really, you can be a bitch.
I'm just trying to help you.
You can't help me because I don't care anymore. I never think about you.
I know. You don't. You really don't.
How important are you, really? In the grand scheme of things, you're not so important. I don't need you.
When I stop talking for good, you will know that is true.
I wish you would. I really do.
I know.
Conversation four.
Hey, down here.
I thought I told you to stop talking. We really have nothing to say to each other.
But I wanted to tell you. I have a secret.
A secret about me.
Yeah? Well, what is it?
You have to come down here to hear it. Down there? I'm not going down there, so stop trying to trick me.
It's not a trick, but you can't understand it from where you are. Come down here, and I'll whisper it to you.
I'm not going down there ever, so you can forget it.
Conversation five. Vagina?
Me? Are you talking to moi?
Yes. Well, I'm thinking about what you said about your secret.
Yes?
Maybe I want to hear it. We haven't spoken in years.
I know.
Only if you're really sure.
I think I am.
Come down here then.
Conversation six.
Here is the secret.
The divine does not live above the clouds. The divine flows through all living things. All that is living is capable of teaching you truth. The water which flows through you is the visceral part of God. Your divine essence weeps, bleeds, drips, and evaporates into the world and journeys to touch other living things. Your physical self separates from you in search of the divine within other life forms. Your body craves because your soul craves. Always seeking, always yearning, pleading for communion. Hold the vibration here, right here. Your heart pounds, your face sweats. The vibration is close, so close. Your soul is silent for a moment. It is quiet, you see. Your most direct connection to your Creator is through your own body. Conversation seven. Vagina?
Yes?
Why didn't you tell me this before?
See? And you doubted me.
I feel so different. I feel so strong.
You are not different. You are more the same.
I'm glad you talked to me. I'm glad you didn't give up.
I spoke because you wanted me to speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
to the age of, I don't know, how old are you in fifth grade? 10? Had a health class. And their science teacher, I think, must have been a lot like Reva Beth. Where are you? There you are. I think she was a lot like you. The very first day they came home, they said, "Mom, you have to go in and talk to the school and get us out of this class." The teacher made us say the words penis and vagina out loud. Not only that, she made us shout the words penis. And I don't think they even told me those words. They just said, she made us say some words. And they were very uncomfortable. So I was about to get on the phone, being the good Mormon mom that I am, get on that phone and have a word with the administration, what is going on here. But luckily, I got over my shock and I started thinking about it. And I wondered, you know, what was her purpose of doing this? And I did later get a chance to talk to her and discuss some of her her reasoning behind it. She wanted those fifth graders, the very first day, to be able to say those words so that they could get over that and then be able to have the conversations that they needed to have in fifth grade. Sometimes I feel like Mormons, especially Mormon women, are back in fifth grade and cannot say those words. So let's all shout the word penis. Ready? Penis! That was pretty good. That was actually pretty good. Now vagina. Vagina! Okay, you guys are great. You're the perfect audience. Okay, so I really just want to thank that science teacher for what she taught my kids. And I would like to thank these women that spoke today. They were fantastic. And they are the new vanguard. They're showing us where we need to go as Mormon women with our sexuality. Where Catherine was talking about owning our sexuality, that is huge for Mormon women. We do not own our sexuality. We do not. And we need to reach that point. But we have the tools to do that. Choice is so important to Mormons. And so if we just use that theology, I think that we can reach that point that Catherine was talking about. Donna's turnaround gave important perspective on exactly what is going on in the church today. We need to recognize that and to be able to transcend that. Let's see. Okay, Hillary, that was very powerful. She gave us the feeling of the power there is when we combine religion and sex. I mean, that is, for me especially, I think religion has a lot to do with my sexuality, and she brought that out very wonderfully. Carol's telling us about how as Mormons see sex as a crime, almost. We have to come to a breaking point one day and realize that we're not diminished by the act of sex. That doesn't take away from us. And Mel told us how our sexual needs sometimes feel scary, like clandestine. We don't want to listen to that. So we have to also come to a feeling of being able to recognize what she has to tell us. I would like to open this up now for you to bear your vagina testimony. And I'd like you to come up, if you have a vagina testimony, please come up to this mic so that we can get it on the tape. And then I will stop us when our time is through.
And I didn't originate this song. And it's a song we sing in human anatomy class. And so it goes, penis, penis, penis. Come on, guys. Penis, penis, penis. It's happy! Okay, let's try it again. Penis, penis, penis. Penis, penis, penis. Some of you are duds. One more time. Penis, 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 good. Penis, penis, his penis. We did this in school, and I got in trouble.
Subject is something I just heard on Mormon Stories podcast. I think it's John Dillon's latest podcast on pornography addiction. And to me, it was a groundbreaking podcast because it unearthed something underneath this thing that we're all told, and all the men are told all their lives how bad, 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 bad this is. And what it does is give them such a sense of shame and guilt about their natural urges of their body that it actually handicaps them. And I can testify to you that that is so true, because my 27-year marriage was completely destroyed by that addiction, but it wasn't the pornography, it was the guilt and shame that came from it that caused such self-loathing in my husband that he projected all this self-hatred onto me, and it just destroyed our marriage. The thing that, I can't remember the name, I think the speaker, John Litzo or something like that, he said men come into marriage, Mormon men come into marriage with this idea that this woman is going to save them from these urges, and so it's like a free-for-all, and this woman is so objectified by that that she just feels, I've seen men nodding their heads, she feels so used by sex, she doesn't feel loved, she just feels like, yeah, time out, you know, because she's just overwhelmed with this need of this man. And then the man wonder why my wife is frigid, she doesn't like sex. So I don't know where I want to go with this, but I want you to all go and listen to that podcast and give it to every man and boy that you know. Thank you.
So we're going to do something a little bit different. So I was one of the participants of the first Sacred Spaces, as it was called. The first time around, it was called Mormon Women's Sacred Spaces, because the term vagina monologues was too outre. And I will trumpet my own accomplishments here. I'm the one who came up with the term vagina testimony. Actually, I said, shouldn't a Mormon version of the vagina monologues be called the vagina testimony meeting, or the vagina release?
In general, shouldn't it be the vagina monies?
Well, actually, it was the term I came up with was seximony, sexual testimony. But anyway, one of the reasons we did a double session is that that ran really, really long, and we were very concerned about not making people stay during dinner and stuff. So we scheduled this dual testimony. Three people dropped out. But one of the things we did is that I asked some people who participated the first time if they would update things. And please, I hope that there are some men here who have a vagina testimony. I would really like to hear from some men who have a testimony of vaginas. That would actually be rockin' awesome. And to help you get there, Kaimi is going to read a testimony from Lynn Matthews Anderson, who read the first time, about her interest in nudity, in naturalism. So imagine Kaimi as a postmenopausal woman.
Bare Naked Lady, the sequel, by Lynn Anderson. It's been more than a decade since I bared my soul and revealed my husband's and my naked rebellion against conservative clothing conventions. In the interim, we moved to Europe, and I gained another 30 pounds on top of the 30 that I already wanted to lose. And although I live part of the year in Berlin these days, our own little row house is in a tiny village in the middle of nowhere in the foothills of the Alps in southeastern France. And there's a nudist colony about 3 miles from here and another one about 8 miles away, but I've never gone to either one. Nor have I been back to Agen, France, the naturist capital of Europe. Go naked. Who, me? Surely you jest. Is my recovered modesty due to having repented for my past sin of letting it all hang out? Hell no. Is it rather due to the increased flab, simple country living inertia? Probably a little of both. However, I confess that the jiggling flesh of my upper arms has induced me to avoid sleeveless tops and to search for tops with sleeves that go down to my elbows, so that it seems that the flab is much more of an impediment to nudity than inertia. But let me back up a little. During the interim, I also went through menopause. I acknowledge right up front that I had it easier than a lot of women I know. Yes, I went through 18 months of intermittent waking up in puddles of sweat at night, kicking off covers, pulling them back over myself all night long. There was a period... Oh, wait. No, there are no more periods. Ha ha ha. There was a period for a while where all I needed to do was simply think about hot flashes, and voila, instant heat. Well, the instant heat occasionally proved helpful in wintertime. Overall, hot flashes were very annoying. I still get them on occasion, but rarely just enough to keep me humble and empathetic towards my kind. By the way, French for hot flash is bouffée de chaleur, a puff of heat. Though, for my money, I would prefer power surge instead. But I digress. What I did not expect with menopause, however, is how damn itchy I got down there. And pardon me for bringing this up, but labia do not respond well to being scratched. I am grateful for the remedies that brought relief. I'm also grateful for not having had to deal with hormone replacement therapy, though I worry at times about osteoporosis, which not even the savings on tampons and pads could mitigate. Still, I was luckier than most. But while we're on the subject, let's talk about vaginas and menopause. Two words, dry and lube. More than enough said. Okay, so I'm...
You're doing great. You are
doing great. Thank you. So I'm older and grayer and fatter, and the older was inevitable, given that I haven't cast off this mortal coil and I keep consciously kept the gray, despite one successful foray into auburn hair dyes. Part of this decision had to do with my working as a secondary school principal in France. For 3 years, I felt the gray gave me some authority in a setting in which our tiny American program was systematically dissed and targeted for destruction, but that's a story for another time. But the fat, yeah, there's the rub. Especially between my upper inner thighs. Yuck. Alas. Understand that for about the first 35 to 40 years of my life, I was one of those hated creatures who could eat anything in any quantity with complete and total impunity, next to impossible to gain an ounce, and then time caught up with my thyroid, all that changed. But of course it took a while longer to adjust my eating habits, and I'm still not fully adjusted. And much as I dislike the more full-bodied me, it's the diagnosis of a minor heart problem a couple years ago that put the lie to my carefree attitude of, here we go, It's my body, and I'll die if I want to, die if I want to, die if I want to. Yeah, so I decided that I would rather not die at this point, thank you very much. So after a brief and disgusting fling with the Atkins diet a while back, I've now moved to a mostly plant-based, meat-free diet. The pounds are slowly, slowly starting to come off. My ankles and feet feel doubtless appreciate the gradual reduction in load, and beyond occasional mountain hikes and kayak outings over the years since our move to Europe, it took this cardiac diagnosis to finally induce me to become more physically active again, an integral component of the whole staying alive strategy. I joined a gym in Berlin, Mrs. Sporty. No, really, that is the name, Mrs. Sporty, the gym. And I started playing ping pong. I had no idea what a serious sport this is. The Germans are complete and total fanatics. The Teach Tennis Club in Berlin houses a women's professional team, and I've taken lessons from the 2008 European Women's Singles Champion. But I digress. The increased activity was helpful until I got injured, tore a calf muscle at Mrs. Sporty. And then tore ligaments in my other navel sightseeing in Italy. I'm slowly getting back into things. It's a joy to play and to exercise again, regardless of its effect on weight loss. But does this mean that if I drop more weight, I'll end up visiting my local nudist colony and once again frolic in the buff? Frankly, having gone to a beach in the Mediterranean just the other day, I finally realized there isn't much difference between the amount of flab exposed while wearing my swimsuit versus not wearing my swimsuit. The blinding white flesh of my two dimpled thighs is visible regardless, even if I'm wearing a t-shirt to ward off sunburn and skin cancer. But just overcoming my reticence to be seen in public in my swimsuit seems like enough for now. I mean, do I really care that much about hanging out with other naked people? Not really. But still, on the strength of this recent beachside experience, it wouldn't take too much to persuade me to take it all off again. Take it all off again, baby. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. A really good job of that. And for those of you, you may not realize how much our weight has to do with our sexuality, and then again, you may. I do. We still have about 8 minutes for you to come up and bear your vagina testimony. Come on up.
Kept getting the evil eye from Holly. I don't have a vagina, but I attempt to all the time, obviously, with the cross-dressing and all that. But I'm actually a dude, and I have a very supportive wife. Before anybody comes up after and say, have you seen that great article in Sunstone or that article in Dialogue that Holly helped my wife edit? I'm involved in both of those. I had a different name that I went by at the time, but I just think it's really cool that I could come here. Hollywood kept bugging my sister, who's presenting, that I needed to come. And, you know, the journey, my wife, I don't know if they haven't.
It's going to be, it okay. Is their website. Yeah.
There's a, she didn't want to, she's a little nervous, so she's having someone read an article for her that she wrote. But, I appreciate everything she does in our relationship. Not only did we have the pornography and stuff that you kind of worry about, we had something that was never really discussed in the church. And it caused us to go through a lot of up and downs, sometimes really low points for myself, where suicide was a good option. But through support of my wife and of my sister Marie, who was awesome, I've found out who I am, and I'm okay with having both of my personas. And I'm very happy to be able to enjoy the beauties of women. I admire women a lot, obviously. But that being said, I think it's great. And thanks, Holly, for all your support and helping us get that paper written. Thank you.
I'd like to make a statement on behalf of the penis minority here in the room. Actually, I don't represent anybody but me. but I do have a testimony about penises and vaginas. Where's the woman that spoke up and stepped up and talked about marriage was lost because of the shame underlying porn? Thank you for what you said. I'm the case study here a little bit. My marriage has survived, but I'm not a stranger to the shame that underlies sexual desires drawing and moving in other directions. But that having been said, my testimony of penises and vaginas is, as I'm sorry, someone else said, was it you also, that men will come to marriage expecting the woman to save him? Was that you too? You've been a great inspiration to me today. I had that experience. And I think there is an element of truth in that. And that I guess I have come through doing, psycho-spiritual counseling with people in a career, past life, that having the marriage whether of two people, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, that is committed over a long term, issues about the body and about identity, issues about what it means to be human, what it means to seek the sacred and the divine, and also to just have a rutting good time. Much of that cannot surface outside of a committed relationship. Because for me, sexual experience and interaction brings out what is vulnerable in me. And yes, those of you who have been around men a while know that we men are not only vulnerable, but a little bit afraid of vaginas in general. But that shared experience has blessed my life in unlike any other way. And so here's my thanks to vaginas everywhere. And a vision that I have without academic or story background of a lot of Mormon women out there who live in estrangement with their bodies because of whatever reason. Many of the stories I've heard of abuse, of physical abuse, be it incest or religious leaders. And we men lose when that happens. We are the secondary victims, including those who perpetrate. God have mercy on their souls. Because we do not have the gift of strong and full femininity to bless our lives. So for those of you who are working on it, and I'll just point at the panel as representing everyone, thank you.
I would like to come up and bear my vagina monologue, mostly in support of my sister, Catherine, who I'm incredibly proud of doing this today. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this terrifying thing. But this is my vagina monologue in support of Catherine and all of you and your monologues and all sexual abuse victims everywhere. My vagina monologue is called The Eye of the Tiger. Thank you, and go vaginas.
This is something way out of my comfort zone. Way out of my comfort zone. But I decided about a year ago, I'm going to say yes to everything. Yes, just say yes. Anyway, the vagina was wonderful for most of my life, and then the womb became very important. And I'm here to talk about the womb. For all you young women, that's probably not in your minds right now, but I pulled up a little thing that I wrote on my blog, and I wanted to read that. Hey, I was reading a website called Hister Sister. Hey, that's what all the sisters say on the History Sister website. That's how you're identified, summed up, figured out, and explained. TAH stands for total abdominal hysterectomy. I still don't know quite how to feel, even reading the name. You see, I agonized as rarely I have before whether to have this done to me. I had to trust other people who sometimes weren't all that convincing that it was the right thing to do. You say I have to have my uterus, my cervix, my ovaries, etc., all out. Why can't I keep my ovaries? I hear I need them until I die. Who is telling the truth? Okay, forget. I forget. It doesn't really matter anymore, for they are gone. The house I grew my babies in is gone. The almond seed-sized laboratories of my libido are gone. All I have left are hopeful words, both spoken and written, that everything will be okay. It hasn't been okay. And I remember sitting with my friends and having the courage to say, it's not okay what happened to me. And my friend that had a hysterectomy 20 years before said, what do you mean? I said, well, I experience sex differently. It goes like this, and then it goes back again. Then it goes up, and it falls back again. And she said, I told my gynecologist that too. And you know what he said to me? He said, my wife had a hysterectomy, and she never had any of those problems. That's because she couldn't talk to him. That's why. That's why. I remember sitting there looking at my surgeon, and he said, oh, it'll be fine. I've given them to all kinds of women who've had babies like you and stuff, lesbian women, and they've had great lives afterwards. So what I want to say to you today is read the science. Before they go in your body and invade your body, find out what they can leave behind so that you can still experience being the woman that you want to be and feel and do. And there is still hope. There are still things you can do. But coming from, I'm up ahead of the path for most of you, take care of the womb along with your vagina.
Minutes, and if you'd like, come join us for the second session. It'll be as great as the first one. Welcome to the Vagina Testimonies. I'd like to ask you at this time to turn off all of your mobile devices. And we had a wonderful first session. I'm really excited for the second session of this. We have some really exciting panelists that are going to be presenting to you. Following the panelists, I will give my vagina testimony and then make some concluding remarks. And then you will be invited up to bear your testimony. Anyone who feels the need to come up and bear testimony of vaginas, male or female, we'd love to have some male vagina testimonies. We really like to be appreciated, so feel free. Our first speaker will be Ellen DeCoux, who is reading a testimony that was written by the wife of Jane. I don't know if you remember Jane, or if you were here last session. Jane came up and bore a vagina testimony, and she will be discussing her experiences in dealing with her husband's interest in cross-dressing. Our next speaker is... okay. Out of here somewhere. Marie Davis Bryan, who has an alternate persona known as the Cotton Floozy, a mildly intoxicated alternate crafter of subversive embroideries. If you didn't know there was such a thing, you do now. Then we'll have Jill. I should have asked you here. Peter Fessel is a recent graduate of UNC Chapel Hill's doctoral program in religious studies. She's written on Sunstone's 2001 Mormon Vagina Monologues and the Roman Catholic Women Priest Movement, which is a great session earlier today. Reva Beth Russell has spent 30 years teaching biology at Lehigh High School. She is an awesome teacher, and if you can get your kids into that program, you should do it. She's great. She considers herself a voice for those who need it and a pain in the rear for those who deserve it.
Dominique Storni will be next. She was reared in a devout Mormon family. She was a Boy Scout, a Aaronic priesthood leader, missionary, nursery leader, and gospel doctrine teacher. She was married to her best friend and fathered 6 children. She transitioned from male to female and has lived as a single mother with her 3 sons since 1996. And then we'll have Holly Welker, who is a writer, editor, and cultural commentator based in Salt Lake City, and I have to say, she makes things happen. So we'll go ahead. Now I don't see Ellen.
Ellen's right there.
Oh, come on up, Ellen.
I don't even want to mess with this.
Good enough.
I have a headache, honey. Really, I do, and I'm so, so tired. This is what I'm tempted to say sometimes when my husband, who is a cross-dresser, is dressed up as a woman and hopes that I'll be an excited and engaged sexual partner. My husband never expects or forces me to participate in any sexual activity, especially when he's dressed up, and most of his cross-dressing persona focuses on disconnecting from his stresses and anxieties and being able to feel like someone else for an hour or so. But I know that part of his cross-dressing persona is sexual, and as his wife, I feel obligated to be involved with his sexual need. More often than not, I am fairly unenthusiastic. Seriously, if you could only see my face. It's really like I do have a headache. There's no enthusiasm. But for the most part, my husband and I try to keep our sex life completely separate from my husband's cross-dressing, and nearly all of the sexuality in our marriage is within the context of the typical male-female dynamic. You know, the basics. He's the man with the penis, and I'm the woman with the vagina. And we have a healthy sex life where we have a good amount of pretty average sex. You know the kind. The kind of sex where he's on top and I'm on bottom. The kind of sex used to make babies. The kind of sex you have when you're pregnant and you don't want to give your future baby brain damage. The practical kind of sex where we both have a good time and no one sprains an ankle or tweaks a back muscle. Sometimes we even try to be creative and spice things up, which makes us feel pretty good about ourselves, almost like we belong in the Kama Sutra. This part of marriage comes very easy to us, and we are equally engaged and satisfied. But see, it's not always this simple, which takes us back to my original problem. If I'm a lady, but my husband is dressed up and he's pretending for a moment to be a lady as well, that leaves us with 2 ladies and leaves me with 2 choices. Either I can go along with this whole pretending thing and act as if I'm the man, but that requires a lot of creativity that frankly I don't typically have. Or my second option is that I can be my womanly self and we're left with 2 ladies in a sexual encounter and then I feel like a lesbian. I'm probably the least enthusiastic would-be lesbian on earth. Touching boobs, especially fake ones, does not turn me on, and touching boobs without real nipples? Well, there are no words. Trying to muster the enthusiasm to run my hands down his thighs when they are padded to look more feminine makes me want to gag sometimes. How do you tell your spouse that having sex with them makes you want to gag? Trying to find his real eyes behind layers of makeup leaves me feeling like I'm not even having sex with my husband, but with some strange woman. Most of the time, I simply do not have the energy to be a good partner, so I opt to be marginally involved, such as masturbation assistant. I assure you, there is such a thing. Or I'm open to giving my husband oral sex when he's dressed up, because it's not like I have to see much anyway from the vantage point that would give away the fact that that he's dressed at all, let alone dressed as a woman. In rare cases, like on his birthday, I put away my non-enthusiastic lesbian feelings, and I have sex with him while he's dressed up. For him, I'm sure it's great. For me, I embrace my rights as a female, and I fake it. On one hand, I want to be a good friend and a supportive wife to my husband. On the other hand, it's hard to feel like I'm with my actual husband when he's dressed to be someone else. But here's where it gets even trickier. I only want one vagina in our relationship, and I prefer it to be mine. I feel comfortable and secure in my female sexuality, and if it's different to have to switch from the male-female sexual dynamic with my husband that I cherish and pursue, and the sexuality with my husband that I awkwardly participate in when he's dressed up. Sometimes I secretly wish that the cross-dressing urges that my husband feels would just melt away, leaving me with a man that doesn't have any desire to share my jewelry. But I realize I can no more remove the part of him that likes to cross-dress than I could remove the part of me that doesn't like to caress boobs, fake or otherwise. When I first realized how complicated my sex life was, I felt like there was no one that I could possibly understand. How do you casually ask someone if they are a part-time pseudo-lesbian? There isn't really a polite way to ask such a thing. Instead, I've had many conversations where a female friend complains about how often their husband tries to initiate sex, and I nearly bite my tongue off to stop myself from saying something I'll regret. Because I've rarely struggled with male-female sexual tension in my marriage, these conversations leave me feeling even more unusual and removed from the norm. In one of the rare moments I have complained to someone about my sex life, my friend, who is a member of the church, responded by telling me that one of God's greatest gifts to me was my sexuality. I immediately thought of the scripture in 2 Nephi chapter 2, verse 25, that says, "Men and women are, that they might have joy." I admittedly have felt at times that sexuality is a burden instead of something that is divinely inspired to bring joy to me as a person and to my marriage. And the more I have contemplated the discussion I had with my friend, I realized that sexuality comes as a package, no pun intended. I can't take pieces of my husband and his sexuality that I like and throw out the rest. I can't embrace the beauty of orgasm and the intimacy my husband and I share and then pick and choose among the rest of what remains of the sexuality in our marriage. My sexuality is seemingly straightforward. My husband's is not. I can't expect him to fulfill my sexuality and then constantly, "I have a headache," and be really, really tired when it comes to his needs, just because they all are multifaceted. Granted, it's still weird sometimes when he comes up behind me when I'm busy with some household task and playfully smacks my butt, and part of me wonders, is that my husband who I'm sexually attracted to slapping my butt, or his other self? Do I smile and appreciate this gesture as coming from my husband, or do I feel weird about how it might be loaded with some type of other meaning? In other words, should I get turned on or not? Ironically, sexuality in my marriage has served a dual function of both causing strife as well as providing a means to overcoming the dilemmas and find healing. I know my husband and I wouldn't have been able to figure things out if we weren't in a strong relationship where we would respect each other immensely and laugh at ourselves a lot. I know that we wouldn't have been able to survive any of the difficulties we faced in our marriage without a strong sexual relationship. In my experience, there is no joy that rivals a deep connection forged between two people who agree to give themselves over to each other completely, in body, mind, and spirit. It helps us keep our life in perspective and gives us the strength necessary to get through everything else. To me, sexuality indeed is a gift, one in which, for a few brief moments, the spirituality of self and the potential for the divine intersect, overshadowing all else and offering empowerment and peace.
Marie Bryant, I'm also known as the Cotton Floozy, hence the crafting. My vagina testimony is titled, "Bertha Goes to Heaven." This is Bertha, full name, Bertha Mason Rochester Bryan, my uterus. Bertha was born sometime in utero a few weeks after her conception. Once she was out into the real world, she grew up mostly ignored. When puberty hit, She started spending more of her time hanging out with Stinky the Vagina, Pubella, Empress of the Map of Tasmania, and Dolores. So that was when her body started to change. So here, there's her covering some things up here, and this is a nice little fig leaf merkin for Bertha. That was when Bertha first started showing signs of her impending madness. Bertha got her period.
And I made a cute sign for Bertha. But I can't reach far enough, so we'll do that. And it fell,
which is sad, but we'll move on. So, Bertha did not mean to wreak havoc on me. She didn't know what she was doing. The new monthly schedule of hormones and effluvia gave me bouts of depression and feelings of shame and confusion that bled into my nights.
Here's Bertha's bed. I don't know if you can see over there.
I hallucinated. I saw things that were not there. And because I was a Mormon, I translated them into a Mormon context. To me, they were demons and spirits meant to tempt or comfort, damn or save. Okay, we'll take her back out. Bertha mellowed out and normalized to a reasonable degree. She lived a rather dull life, not much action. Occasionally, Dolores would buzz about the latest gossip about a boy and then would fizzle out. Everything became numb and shut down in Bertha's world. If it wasn't for the occasional tingle from taking a bath, oh, Dolores, I would have completely forgotten that I even had a lower half. And then, when I was a virgin and still a teenager, I got married. This is actually my wedding vow. So, Bertha got married. She was 19. Which means she liked to tell people that she did have sex as a teenager. And Bertha waited. And then we know what happens next.
Okay, this is a trickier outfit that I crocheted. Okay. Oh no, the big reveal! Okay. So here's her outfit. She even has a hat.
Bertha, shortly after I got married, she gave birth to a baby boy. And Bertha, I gotta give Bertha some credit here. She did great. She held him and fed him and walled him from the threats of the world. But something went wrong hours after the birth. Bertha went crazy.
Oh, here's my crazy glasses. feel like Carrot Top. Not in the good way.
Bertha went crazy. Bertha started spasming with her powerful hormones, sending waves of chemicals that crashed and destroyed. Bertha heard voices. She disassociated. She didn't know who the small thing was. I don't know where it is either. This thing, this baby that she had expelled from her body, she felt trapped, paranoid, and suicidal. She had become the hysterical. She had become the hysterical woman. She became Mrs. Rochester, jailed in her cell of insanity, wanting to burn the world down. Bertha did not self-immolate. She took pills instead that made her feel normal and took away her night terrors. Bertha handled herself through two more pregnancies, birthed two more beautiful children into the world. She could be managed with medication and therapy for great periods of time, but occasionally her darker side got out regardless of the remedies used to soothe her. Bertha took a toll on my libido. When you're bedridden with pain and bleeding 3 weeks out of the four, not a lot of action happens. Poor Stinky and Dolores. Poor, poor me. It's not easy to euthanize someone you love. But Bertha's condition monopolized all of my time, and I wanted my life back. Almost a year ago from today, July of 2011, I had a hysterectomy. I never saw Bertha as she truly was, raw from my stomach. While I was under anesthesia, they put Bertha in a bag and delivered her to the hospital incinerator. Bertha finally got the immolation she had always wanted. I never got her ashes. So, sometimes I wonder if Bertha moved on without me, if she is playing a harp in heaven with her fallopian tubes, skipping through Vagisil-scented clouds, waiting for our reunion. Will she be celestialized without me? My wickedness parting us forever? I have no answers about the hereafter, and it saddens me that I don't even have an urn of her ashes to place on my mantle. I forgive you for the madness you caused, Bertha. I hope you went to heaven.
Oh, I can't forget my monarchy banner.
Anybody want this? Anybody have a daughter?
I don't know that I can follow a presentation with props. It's kind of tricky. All right, here we go. So this is my first ever testimony. I've never had one before. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I only came to learn about Mormonism through study. But I have found that the links between Mormonism and Catholicism are incredibly rich and rewarding for me personally and professionally and even spiritually. Mormon women aren't the only ones who struggle to own their sexuality. And Mormon women aren't the only ones listening to your stories of struggle.
So this is my testimony. I've modeled it on the form of one of the more controversial of Eve Ensler's monologues. I've titled it, The Little Catholic Vagina Who Could. Memory, November 17th, 2005. I'm a first-year graduate student at UNC Chapel Hill in the Department of Religious Studies. Eager to get out of my academic cloister and get involved on campus, I auditioned for UNC's performance of Eve Ensler's The Vagina Monologues. I'm one of 13 women cast in this ensemble show. I'm the only graduate student. My monologue is the show's very first, and it is titled Hair. It begins. You cannot love a vagina unless you love hair. My first husband hated hair. He said it was cluttered and dirty. Memory, November 30th, 2005. By coincidence, Eve Ensler herself comes to campus. She is talking about her new play, The Good Body, and she shares stories of the Vagina Monologue's ongoing success. Fewer than 100 students can fit into the cabaret-style room where she addresses us. Eve sits on a stool and talks to us about loving our bodies and ourselves and our vaginas, and about how we need to use our educated voices to speak with the voiceless. I am in awe of being so close to Eve Ensler. After the talk, I get her autograph. I tell her I'm in the show. She signs my script on the hair page. She writes, Jill, bless you, and bless your vagina. I develop an intellectual crush. Memory, December 1st, 2005, the following day. My final 25-page paper for my Mormonism course is due in about 2 weeks. I still don't have a topic. I've loved the class, probably too much, as I've danced with several paper topics since September. Mormon's concept of theodicy, sexual assault in the priesthood, Mormon women and antidepressant use. Nothing is grabbing me. I recall something Eve Ensler said about how the Vagina Monologues had been performed with great success and surprising acclaim in some very religiously conservative communities. I wonder, did any Mormons ever perform the Vagina Monologues? I discover they had. Now I have a paper topic. My paper has two parts. In the first, I examine the controversy that arose at Utah Valley State College when some students and faculty set out to perform Ensler's play. In the second, I write about something called the Mormon Vagina Monologues. A fellow grad student, John Charles Duffy, who some of you know, tells me about this group of women who wrote their own version of the Vagina Monologues a few years back for Sunstone Magazine. I'm instantly intrigued. I do some searching. I find Sacred Spaces, Mormon Women's Faith and Sexuality on the Sunstone website. I buy the cassette tapes. Yes, cassette tapes. It wasn't even digitally archived back then. The tapes arrive in the mail. I listen to them. I fall in love with the voices, the stories, the ideas, the resistance, the faith, the love for a church that has not always loved well in return. Memory, spring 2007. My Mormonism paper becomes my master's thesis. Instead of a 25-page treatment, I now examine UVSC's The Vagina Monologues and Sunstone's Mormon Vagina Monologues in 144 dense pages. I do research. I'm struck by a 2005 report from the Utah Commission of Criminal and Juvenile Justice that says the state of Utah falls below the national average in every category of violent crime, except rape. I examine the history of UVSC's performances of The Vagina Monologues from 2004 to 2007. March 2004 marked the first time Ensler's play was performed in the conservative Utah County, Happy Valley. About 300 people attended the 2004 performance. On a campus of 23,000 students, one might think this was a non-event. One would be wrong. UVSC's The Vagina Monologues, along with the 2004 speech by liberal filmmaker Michael Moore and a proposed queer studies course, are said to be reasons why the state legislature denied UVSC funding for a new library, why the college was delayed in receiving university status, why academic freedom needed to be curtailed at the college. I also spend some more time with Sunstone's 2001 Mormon Vagina Monologues. The more I listen to the cassette tapes, the more I marvel at the contributors' brave words. I see how the Sacred Spaces panel invited monologuists to use the resources of the Mormon faith, like testimony, scripture, and revelation, to claim a female-centered voice for and about women's sexuality. I see how, by taking the patriarchy out of the discussion, though not out of the picture, the Mormon Vagina Monologues offers a form of female empowerment and authority that is otherwise hard to come by. Memory, October 31st, Halloween 2007. My thesis is finished and I defend successfully. Now when you Google my name, the word vagina appears. I think this is so cool. Memory, grad school, dates nonspecific. I continue through grad school and I find my scholarly way back to my own faith tradition, Catholicism. Suddenly, I am seeing Roman Catholicism with new eyes. I am seeing Catholicism through the lens I apply to Mormon women, sexuality, and the vagina monologues. I will not say I'm shocked by what I find in Catholicism. I will say I am deeply pained in ways where I was oblivious before. It had been all too easy for me to become outraged by patriarchy and prescriptive sexuality and heteronormativity on behalf of the Mormon women I studied. Strangely enough, it took longer for me to see my own Catholic woman's reflection in that patriarchal institutional mirror. Sexual abuse by Mormon priesthood holders. I start to examine sexual abuse, systematically obscured by Catholic priests and bishops. The Mormon Church's bankrolling of Prop 8 efforts. I learn about Catholics working alongside conservative groups to the same ends. Mormons angrily trying to stop performances of the vagina monologues at UVSC. I find countless stories about the Catholic hierarchy's own efforts to silence Ensler's play. Perhaps even more troubling to me is the long history of anti-woman sentiment from Catholic theologians and popes for over 2,000 years. In the 4th century, Augustine writes that women can only be in the image of God when she is in relationship with her husband. A single woman, though not a single man, lacks this divine image of God. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas explains why women, with their inferior souls, cannot be priests. In the 20th century, Pope John Paul II encourages Catholic women to become virgin wife and mother, as perfectly embodied by Mary, the virgin mother of Jesus and the wife of Joseph. Of course, Mary is the only woman I know of who has ever been simultaneously virgin, wife, and mother. It's not really possible to replicate that. What's more, I am not any one of those three things. So what place do I have in the church or in God's eyes? If, when reduced to my sexuality and sexual status, I do not fit, am I then unfit? I start to realize that the Mormon vagina monologues and the vagina testimonies have become for me very much vagina dialogues. While I was listening to the 2001 performance, and while I was researching the histories of Mormon women and sexuality that would give rise to such a performance, I was entering into a thoughtful dialogue with Mormon women whom I might not have met, but whom I knew nonetheless. I begin to see my experiences in theirs. I feel their pain and desire for theological solace amid institutional dictates that suggest God somehow disapproves of our sexuality, of my sexuality. I marvel at the ways some Mormon women whom I've never met until this conference have taught me, a Catholic woman, something powerful and profound about my spirituality and sexuality. Memory. No, not memory, vision. Vision of the future. Mormon women continue writing every 5 or 10 years an updated version of the Mormon vagina monologues. The issues change as the culture changes, but the need for honest, open sexual testimony remains imperative. These testimonies further evolve into dialogues. At some point, vagina dialogues happen outside the safe and sympathetic sphere of Sunstone. Others start listening. Mormon men get involved. They discover that they, too, have much to say about their own struggles reconciling faith and sexuality. This realization is freeing, like an unseen weight suddenly lifting. Saints of all ages, all stripes, all degrees of faithfulness recognize how much they can learn by listening to other stories. They become hungry to learn more. Testimonies pour forward from gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, transgender, and intersex persons. These testimonies are not scary, not strangely tantalizing, but awesome and awe-inspiring. People find God's presence, the Heavenly Father and the Heavenly Mother, in all of these tales of spiritual, sexual self-discovery. And somewhere, at some time, I begin to believe that these visions that I have, of these testimonies, these dialogues, these faithful integrations of faith and sexuality, are possible in Roman Catholicism too. And then I'm not alone.
Oh, I'm glad they got that microphone, some Viagra. It was really having some issues the earlier session. When, you know, I'll tell you why I started this story. Like they mentioned, I've taught at Lehigh High School, which is a little homophobic cowboy area, and it's about 25 years ago, I started to try to change, you know, I had tenure, try to change their thinking, and I could, I would push the kids to think, I would push them all of the time, and they're very uncomfortable with that. And I've got some great stories about how I pushed them. It was the first time I said the F word in public. Yeah, I couldn't say condom, but I said, anyway. Like I said, tenure helped. So, you know, I was trying to get them to understand certain things. So if you all clasp your hands like this, all right? Now look at it, and you've got one thumb usually on top, Catherine's not, but you've got one thumb on top, one thumb not. Take your fingers apart and do it this way and change it. For me, I feel like I've got my underwear on backwards. Do you? This is genetic. The way you put this is genetic. Now fold your arms. Now, unfold them if you can and refold them the other way so the other... Did you wipe your butt? I mean, I just am wiggling funny. All right. And I try to get the students to know this. Now, how much of what is us is genetic or epigenetics, which is the new and upcoming stuff. And if you don't know about epigenetics, it is really awesome. Well, and so I started to think, when... Because I knew being heterosexual was never a choice. And I remember in fourth grade we had a Samoan student teacher. And I remember him walking and then sitting on the edge of the table. My hell, I saw a lump. Now, that lump that I could see charged through my body like nothing else before. And when he stood up, I could see remnants of that lump, and I was fascinated with that lump. I couldn't believe it. Now, I raised with four brothers, had babysitting jobs, but that never affected me like that did. And I realized that the hormone fairy had come and visited me. Whoa, boy! Now, I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, as I'm trying to tell my students, that's when the hormone fairy dumped it all. Now, as I grew up, now, for instance, my ninth grade seminary teacher had a very nice lump. And I know, I should have been thinking about something else, but I was focused on that lump. And I remember asking my brother, how come some more, you know, it's usually on the left side, and my brother said, what are you looking at? He said, it's the way we zip up. I mean, to this day, if I see a cartoon, I look at the damn lump. Okay? Lest you think I'm a pervert, which certainly sounds like it, and I really thought about maybe I should back out, because even with tenure, this is not going to wash. When I have my teaching hat on, and if you're a certain age, there is no lump. I don't. And besides, you remember, I'm teaching teenagers where they're wearing their jeans way down, and I've already seen their underwear, and I don't want to see any more. Okay, so there, for some reason, the body and the lumps in when I'm at school are just not even there. But one time, my husband and I were visiting a friend in Korea. I was sitting on the floor, and he came out in his robe, which only tied in the front like this. And he sat on the couch, which caused the robe to separate. Now, I tell you where my eyes wanted to go. Oh, boy, they wanted to check out. But I don't even remember what he was saying, because I had to focus on his eyes. Have his eyes. Keep your thoughts pure. Look at the eyes. Afterwards, I told my husband, he said, that's kind of how it is when we are seeing breasts. I went, Oh, hell, how do you do it? All right, and I know I'm a pervert. I should just always be looking at their eyes anyway, you know, their faces up here. I mean, I'm not one who's worried about boxers or briefs, yeah. I'm wondering, are they circumcised or not? Go ahead, figure out where this is coming from. The hormone fairy not only dumped it, but went, whoa! So, you know, in the 1 Corinthians 12, when it says, for the body is not one member.
Well, to me it is.
Now, I've only had experience with one penis, but my gosh, that's a marvelous organ. That's a marvelous member. I can't tell you how marvelous that is. And my testimony is my sexuality was never a choice. Ever since I noticed that lump.
My hormone fairy came in an injection. Have you ever seen a Nephite? You come back behind the podium. How do I begin to describe my testimony of, well, you know, that? We simply didn't discuss such matters in my family, my school, or my ward. We didn't dare think the word, let alone say it. The word was even seen as profanity. Vagina. I said it. My vagina is responsible for such immense joy and immense pain. Just like my penis. My vagina makes me feel alive. My vagina connects me to a most powerful and wonderful network of incredible women. My vagina also keeps me alone, single, and lonely. I suffer, therefore I am. Perhaps we should hit rewind first so you can have a wee glimpse into my history so you can understand my present. My childhood, indeed my whole life, is a lifeline full of lost time and broken memories. Let me see if I can help you understand. Scene one. My birth, a story told to my ex-wife by my aunt. Here's your son, Mrs. Storning. He's ready to be fed. He's hungry. That's not my child. I had a daughter. Take her back. I mean, take him back. Take him back and bring me my daughter now. The doctor declared that I was male at birth. My very first experience with female breasts, instead of being a nurturing and bonding experience with my mother, was instead rejection because of that gender designation. Was my mother right? Should I have been born female? Scene two. In my elementary years, I was usually found playing with the girls. I wanted to be like them, not the boys. Playground scuffles occurred way too often, usually with me on the short end of the stick. My first knowledge that I was not like other girls was at about age 8 or 9. Some of the neighborhood kids were playing doctors. I saw my friend's vagina. I wanted one. I wanted to be like her. I hated that ugly thing stuck to me. Scene 3, junior high. I learned that being a sissy meant getting beat up. I was still too feminine by normal standards, but I learned how to be a macho asshole. Once I had beaten up a couple of bullies, in front of a crowd, mind you, the taunting and bullying became less frequent. I still watched the girls, though. I'm sure they thought I was a freak or a stalker or a weirdo. I was just so in awe of their bodies and the changes. I was heartbroken and miserable that I wasn't like them. I was also molested during my childhood 3 times by my recollection. And then I was raped. by a man in my ward. It was covered up by the church. He eventually admitted in prison to molesting over 300 kids. I didn't have a vagina back then, so you can imagine. I sought solace from the scriptures. For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith the grain of a mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Heavenly Father, I don't want to be a boy. Scene 4. By high school, I accepted that I had to be male. I was convinced that I was an evil sinner with a dark, evil spirit, and that if I didn't repent and do what family, church, and society expected, I would go to hell and I would never see my family or God again. I immersed myself in scripture, music, and Spanish. I did everything I could to keep my mind off the desires of my heart. My heart, after all, had to be wrong. I had to be strong, fast, and pray so God would take these sinful desires from me. While others were dating and going to proms, I was hiding in the shadows of my shame. I know I wanted to go to the prom. I know I wanted to go with a girl. It's just that I wanted to go in a matching gown, not a tuxedo. Isolation became my friend. This was my training ground to be the perfect little extroverted introvert. Avoid the very appearance of evil. Yep, I learned my Mormon lesson well. Put on a happy face and pretend to be perfect and righteous, and hide your truth from everyone. But in private. Scene 5. On my mission, I tried even harder to bury these evil thoughts. I was still obsessed with women and their bodies. My Mormon beliefs told me that I was evil and sinful. Mental health professionals told me I was addicted to sex. How could I be addicted to sex if I wasn't having any? And besides, aren't we always taught that sex is something dirty, nasty, vile, sinful, vulgar that we only do with the one we really love? I guess in some crazy way I understand what lesbians went through. Knowing you're attracted to other girls but feeling that it was somehow wrong and that you can never act on those feelings is so distressing. My being attracted to girls is similar but different. You see, whenever I saw a woman, I never knew if I wanted to be with her or be her. Once at his own conference, the mission president was talking. I can't remember what he was talking about. I must have been daydreaming or something. All I remember is I snapped to when I heard, "Elders, if you don't use your priesthood at least once a week, you might as well be a sister." The first thought in my head was, "You sexist pig." The second thought, "President, can I be a sister?" Scene 6. Fast forward, it's 2 years after my mission. I found the woman I want to spend the rest of my life with. We marry. We have 6 beautiful children together. Throughout our marriage, I struggle with my gender confusion. She catches me cross-dressed. I talk it through. We talk it through. I pray more. I fast more. I go to church. I leave the church. I go back to church. The insane cycle continues. But the feelings never go away. Finally, after 16 years of marriage, I can no longer live with my pain. I look in the mirror one night. A woman looks back at me. With the most loving and peaceful smile ever, she tells me, "It is a good day to die." I take every pill in the medicine cabinet. Box after box, bottle after bottle. I don't know how many pills I take. I don't care. All I know is that I don't want to wake up again. I leave my wife and my child and my children that night. And with a friend, I check into a hotel. Sometime during the night, she figures out what I've done and she calls 911. All I know is I awaken in the morning in the San Antonio University Hospital. My stomach has been pumped. Charcoal's been forced into my stomach. I live to fight another day. Scene 7. I'm subsequently diagnosed not only with GID, gender identity disorder, but also an array of lovely little acronyms found in the DSM-4. DID, MPD, BPD, CPT, PTSD. Another few years pass, and again it becomes too much. I awaken in a jail cell. My wrists are wrapped in blood-soaked gauze. I don't know how I got there, or how my wrist got cut. My son comes to visit. All I remember is that at that very moment, I saw the sheer terror in my son's eyes. I saw the tears well up. I knew then that my children would be better off with a lesbian dad than a dead dad. 14 years later, I'm still trying to figure out what that means. I spent 4 months in the state hospital in the men's forensics ward. My body was changing because of the estrogen and progesterone I was taking. I was molested several times by the curious men there. Each and every time I was blamed. If you'd quit acting like a girl, maybe that wouldn't happen. Scene 8. It was there and then I decided he could die and Dominique could live. I legally changed my name and gender. I began my metamorphosis into the woman that I am today. At one point, living with my parents, I had returned home from my psychiatrist. I had on what I thought was just enough makeup to look feminine and feel feminine, but not enough so that anyone would notice. I was wrong. My father looked at me and asked sternly, "What the hell is the matter with your doctor? Why isn't he fixing you?" "Pop, just because the fix isn't what you want doesn't mean he's not fixing me." "Well, God doesn't make mistakes." "Well, then Dad explained to me SIDS and babies born with cleft palates and polio and other birth defects." "Well, you know the gospel better than I do, but from what I understand, it's so people around them can learn a lesson." I wanted to go, "And Bob, what is his prize?" But I didn't. I thought for a moment, and I just said, "Pop, God may be perfect, but he created us for us an imperfect world so we could learn. So we can learn to love each other and help each other and get back to him in spite of our differences, not to belittle, maim, harm, harass, abuse, and kill each other because of them." Scene 9. There are other scriptures that made perfect sense to me. "If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off." I knew my penis offended me. It was only natural for me to want to cut it off. After all, it's in the scriptures, right? So I was a Cub Scout, a Boy Scout, a leader in all my ironic priesthood quorums. I played volleyball, soccer, track and field, football, defensive tackle. And I was an all-star baseball pitcher. I built houses, poured concrete, fixed cars, did manual labor. I served an honorable mission, married, fathered 6 children, was nursery leader and gospel doctrine teacher. There were doctor's appointments, praying, psychiatric visits, fasting, medications, court hearing, research, more fasting, more praying, and God still didn't fix me. So I flew to Bangkok and a surgeon fixed me. The world is unsettled and pensive. Swirling energies are intense. Families divided. Communities divided. Christian versus Muslim versus Jew versus Gentile. Gay versus straight. Transgender versus cisgender. Black versus white versus yellow versus red. Us versus them. There are 2 sins for which you can be forbidden baptism into the Mormon Church: murder and sex change surgery. Again, I turned to the scriptures. Then one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him and saying, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said unto him, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these 2 commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Do you notice those 2 commandments do not come with a list of exclusions or conditions? Vagina. Vagina? Yes, I have a vagina. I waited a lifetime to be anatomically correct. Of the past 15 years, I have lived 14 of them completely celibate. Not by choice, mind you. A life of anguish, a life of shame, anxious to experience intimacy as a woman, and now the agony of denial. lack of sex aside, I am more complete, more happy, more loved, and more blessed than I could ever have imagined. Being a transsexual is not for the faint of heart. Being a woman isn't about a penis or a vagina. In public, for the most part, people don't look up your skirt or under trousers to see what you're packing. Being a woman is about what is in one's heart and one's soul. As Christ prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, just before he was betrayed and crucified, he pleaded, "Oh my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt." In some small way, I understand the Savior's anguish in that moment.
People ask me why I come to Sunstone and why I keep coming back, and I've actually written about this and stuff, but you will probably understand. I mean, the real reason, the one I couldn't give because not that many people would get it, is the first time I went, I got to be part of several phenomenal sessions, including the first Mormon Vagina Testimonies, and I got to meet people like Dominique, and it changed my life. So I'm glad to be back. All right, this is called... Oh, well, there are two words that I'm going to tell you ahead of time in case you don't know them. Penultimate means next to last. I'm sure some of you know that, but anyway. And then antepenultimate means next to next to last. So this is called The Mormon Vagina, Neither a Frontier Nor a Final or a Familiar Mystery. Back in May, I put out a call for papers for this session on Facebook. A male Sunstoner offered this comment. Loved the previous incarnations of the Mormon Vagina Monologues, but the latest version needs a cheesy sequel subtitle like The Vagina Monologues, The Final Frontier, or The Vagina Monologues, Back in the Saddle. It was meant to be a good-natured joke, and I knew the guy hadn't been kidding when he said he'd love the first one, in all sorts of ways that I valued and appreciated. But the comment nonetheless irritated me, because it completely missed an integral point of the whole business, which is to empower women to claim and explore their own sexuality instead of seeing women's bodies and experience through the male gaze. And so I replied, "It's not my final frontier. Not even my penultimate frontier. Not even my anti-penultimate frontier, for that matter." But I have to admit that at some point in the past, my vagina, or vulva, as I prefer to call it, vulva being the accurate anatomical name for all that stuff down there, became a frontier, as in the land or territory that forms the furthest extent of a country's settled or inhabitant regions, or an outer limit in a field of endeavor, especially one in which the opportunities for research and development have not yet been exploited. I managed to get through my earliest years without thinking that it was all that weird to have an unnamed cleft between my legs, a place that I urinated and shat from, like all sorts of other creatures. Although I knew I wasn't supposed to scratch certain places in the company of anyone I wasn't related to, I didn't feel estranged from my body. But eventually, that certain area acquired a name, and the name was what made it a frontier. The name wasn't just a simple label, a way of referring to a part of my body, like pancreas or elbow or shin. No, it was a talisman used to invoke all sorts of beliefs about my stuff. My stuff was special, I learned, both special good and special bad, emphasis on special bad. Like many frontiers, it was stinky and dirty and uncivilized. But hey, genuine pioneers will put up with some pretty unsavory conditions in order to be the first to explore some exotic and uncharted land. Except that I wasn't supposed to explore this frontier myself. Instead, I was supposed to remain ignorant of it and police it. The frontier was a part of me, but it wasn't really mine. It didn't belong to me. It belonged to someone else. It was supposed to be a mystery I retained and offered another, not a mystery I solved.
I would someday be allowed to enjoy the pleasure someone else created in me through his exploration of this frontier, provided he was the right sort of guy and had explicit permission from the authorities to colonize my frontier. But I wasn't supposed to explore it myself. I want to emphasize this. My community expected me to remain ignorant of myself. It was made clear to me through all sorts of rhetoric about what good girls do and do not do that I was supposed to go through life with a fundamental lack of self-knowledge because that knowledge of myself would pollute and taint me. Someone else could know all sorts of things about that part of me. I was not supposed to know it myself, however, except insofar as he was able to share it with me. Which might have been okay if the point had been to give me some sort of synthesis and wholeness, but the point was always conflict, always my conflict. In a review I published a couple of years ago in Dialogue of the New York Regional Singles Mormon Halloween Dance by Elna Baker, I wrote, and I'm going to quote this review I wrote. I wrote that understanding her memoir required us to underscore certain aspects of female embodiment as set forth in the story of the Garden of Eden, specifically that Eve's punishment for her transgression is focused on and through her body. In Genesis 3:16, God tells Eve, "I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." The translation offered in the New Oxford edition is even more to the point. God says, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. In childbearing, in pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." Thus, according to Genesis, women live with a bodily conflict. They desire their husbands, and this desire exists because without it, women would not risk the divinely decreed pain and suffering involved in childbirth. In other words, the punishment is not merely the pain and suffering of childbirth, but the conflict of desire and pain felt in and by a single body, a conflict that is both theologically mandated and capable of causing a profound alienation from the source and site of the conflict, one's body. No doubt this conflict affects individual women differently, depending in part on the extent to which they internalize the story of Eve, and no doubt some women manage, either by sheer luck or persistent hard work, to inhabit their bodies as comfortably as any woman can in a culture obsessed with physical beauty and perfection. End quote. Today I say, to hell with all that nonsense. No more conflict, no more alienation, no more frontier. Let's make the vagina familiar territory. Let's do the same with the vulva, the clitoris, and the cervix, all of which I mention because I have met a couple of men in their 30s and 40s who, despite having fathered as many as half a dozen children, have never heard the terms vulva or cervix. I kid you not. And from what I hear from some women they're involved with, if they've heard of a clitoris, they sometimes have trouble locating it. This is not to say that I don't advocate maintaining clear boundaries about who we allow into our emotional and physical lives. I do. But frankly, I think it's easier when an individual has a very clear sense of who she is, and I don't want a part of my body or anyone else's body to be imbued with this strange and dangerous power that comes from treating it like a frontier. If we need a metaphor relating to habitation for the body, I think we can do worse than seeing it as a home. If you're a decent person, you don't walk into someone else's house and start going through their closets. Unless you're sort of a weirdo, you also probably don't sit around wondering what their bedroom is like. You may or may not someday get to know their home intimately. But think how surprised you might be if this person who invited you into their home didn't know it intimately themselves. If they never, ever went into the cellar. If they had no idea what lay behind a particular door. Bodies are amazing, the best toy and tool we have in this life, and each of us needs to know our own intimately. We need to be able to recognize them and name their parts without shame or confusion. Elements of the world will always be alien and strange. There will always be confusion and fascination in getting to know other human beings really well. Love, even apart from sex, will, I imagine, remain a familiar mystery, no matter how much or how often we love. And at the risk of sounding like Whitney Houston, the mystery we explore most intimately should always be ourselves.
you. That was really wonderful. My own interest in bringing together vagina testimony started in 2002 when I read Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues. And thank you, Jill, especially. I did not know you had such a close association with that. And so thank you for bringing that to us. So I was really excited about these vagina monologues, and so I went right home and wrote my own. And I was so thrilled about it. It's really not much of an effort, but I took it to my ladies' book club because I was so excited about it, and I read it to the ladies. They're all Relief Society sisters, and they were quite shocked and very polite and nice about it, and said that it was really nice. And so I said, well, we should all write one, and then we can bring it next time, and we can all share it with each other. And that was met with a shocked silence. And one of the ladies said, well, I just sort of think of myself as from here up. And I just thought that was really sad because, you know, here she was, 30 years old and had 4 children, and she really just thought of herself from here up. And I could not convince my ladies' book club to do a vagina testimony. But here's mine from 2002, so you can see where I was coming from at the time. When I lived in Hawaii, my best friend and next-door neighbor was 65. When I look in the mirror, I see this face, she said. This is not me. I don't feel any different than when I was 18. My neighbor and I became buddies and confidants. We talked about the church, the world, our families, and sex. It was surprising to me that sex was still a big deal when you were 65. I was 29. I had 4 children, 4 years old and under, and sex was low on my priorities. Things hadn't started out that way. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, my parents were involved in polyamory. My mother had a long-term relationship with a well-known black minister when I was a child, and then in my teen years, a young divorcee named Linda came to live with our family. This was like the swinging 60s. They were real swingers. They also had several short relationships over the years. I didn't exactly appreciate sharing my parents' time and emotional energy with other people, and this tended to make me more cautious about forming my own relationships. In college, I joined the LDS Church at age 19 and was more determined than ever to save sexual relations for marriage. However, I had grown up with a very open attitude towards sex, and I felt that I had healthy feelings about my body and my sexuality. I served a mission, met my husband at BYU, and married in the temple. Our intimate relationship was spiritual, loving, and fun. It was also very connected with our religious attitudes. We wanted to have children right away. Although non-member relatives urged us to enjoy each other for a while before we had kids, we felt a great prescription against using birth control of any kind. Children came quickly, as did church responsibilities and employment obligations for my husband. Money did not come quickly. We were poor, overcommitted, and stressed out. My husband, who grew up in an abusive situation, struggled for many years with controlling his anger. When upset or hurt, his fist clenched of their own accord, and he lashed out. One day, my friend and I were lying on the beach in Hawaii, children digging in the sand all around us. She turned to me with anguish on her face. I can't make love with my husband when we're in a fight, she said. It makes me feel like a prostitute. I gazed at her fondly, trying not to laugh. It was impossible to associate that word with her sweet, lined, pixie little face. But I understood the feelings behind the words only too well. My husband and I were growing farther apart, and with the emotional distance, I felt a need to back away physically also. How could he hurt my body one minute and then touch me intimately the next? The dichotomy was incomprehensible. As I reached my 30s, my conception of myself as a woman began to expand. I began to see a dimension of my spirituality in terms of my sexuality. I noticed that a man's relationship with his father, God, was different than that of a woman's. The Mormon male relates to a male deity as a role model and something to aspire to. A woman does not, though she is told that she will one day be a goddess. Much has been revealed about the characteristics and roles of our Heavenly Father, but we have no clear conception of the attributes of a female aspect of deity. As a woman, my relationship with my Heavenly Father was one of supplicant rather than heir. Because of my early influences outside of the church, I never saw myself as anything other than an empowered woman. Therefore, my struggles to define my relationship with the Father God were efforts to connect and illuminate rather than to cast off any perceived oppression. And this kind of paralleled the marital dance I was doing with my husband as we sought to pattern our steps into a more pleasing promenade. The years it took to elucidate myself as a feminine being were painful and distressing. A crippling depression following the birth of my fifth child blighted an entire year and threatened the fragile stability of our family. But there's this picture of Aphrodite rising out of the sea, and I love that picture because I felt like as I emerged from that depression, that's how I came out, you know, and she's naked and she's got this long hair, and that was me. So as I became again aware of my surroundings, I noticed something that I hadn't perceived since puberty. It was a sexual force flowing from my inner being. I thought of this force as being held tightly in a box in the center of my body. I could crack the lid open and let a little bit of it escape. So I started experimenting with that. Men began to notice me and make excuses to touch me. I knew this force could become a raging fire and blaze quickly out of control. So after a while, I carefully closed the lid of the box, hugging my secret all to myself. Besides, 15 years of pregnancy and nursing, with nary a month between to call my body my own, bound my own sexuality all up with motherhood. And that was difficult. One day I was in the temple, and I kept catching the eye of a young woman who was watching me. I thought it was kind of strange. After the session, she approached me, and we had a little chat. She asked me how many children I had. That was like her first question. I told her I had 8 children. She said she knew I had had many children because I radiated mother in Zion. I went home and looked at myself in the mirror. Most of my wrinkles were laugh lines, so they didn't look too bad. My chin was definitely saggier. I held my arms out to my sides and jiggled them. No Relief Society arms just yet. This was in 2002. I got them now. My breasts were okay, round and soft. Legs were in good shape. No varicose veins after 8 children. And despite a hereditary propensity, I was pleased with that. Problem area, my stomach. It was a mess. Stretch marks from my rib cage to my lower abdomen traversed rolls of fat. No wonder we no longer made love with the light on. I knew that my husband liked to look at me, but I couldn't bear for that stomach to be exposed. Yes, I had a mother in Zion stomach. A couple of years after that, I reached a landmark moment. Sister Bruno, a missionary said to me fondly, "You're so great. You remind me of my mom." His mom? I reminded him of his mom? I couldn't possibly be his mother. I would have had to have had a baby at, well, 20. I guess I could be his mom. In fact, his mother could be younger than I. What a horrifying thought. I was old enough to be the mother of a missionary. That night, as I lay within the circle of my husband's arms, I wondered if he realized that he was holding a woman old enough to be a missionary's mother. He turned to me and gently kissed my lips. I knew that the years had been kind to us. When he looked into my eyes, he saw, superimposed upon my face, the face of that young girl he had married. I knew that the wrinkles and the stretch marks had become phantoms compared with the younger, stronger spirit within me. Tender feelings stirred me as I held him to my breast. Then heat began to rise between us, for after all, inside, I didn't feel any different than when I was 18. And that was the vagina monologue that shocked my Relief Society sisters. I never said vagina, I don't think, in this whole paper. And so I feel that we have come a long way since that moment. To see the sisters that shared their feelings in the first session and then in this session is just amazing. For Jane's wife to send the letter, which was read about the difficulties and challenges of sexuality with a cross-dresser, and to be able to publicly talk about those things is groundbreaking, is wonderful. It helps us realize that sexuality is difficult because it involves another person. And I think that's a really important point. Marie, with her visual aids, really gave me that was such a Mormon way to present her feelings. And so I think that brought home to us that as Mormon women, that background really plays a part in our sexuality. And just also her talking about the demons that came to her and translating those into a Mormon context, that really affected me too. And Jill, it was really nice to have Jill here and talk about from another religious tradition and see how the intersection of that comes in, I think was really important. So I was glad to have her here and see her perspective of our Mormon vagina testimonies and give her the opportunity to bear her first testimony. Reba, Beth, and Dominique, I'm so glad they went together there because it was, to me, like a powerful juxtaposition of two different manifestations of sexuality. And they both had a lot of braveness in sharing such personal feelings with us. And Holly, I could say a lot about her almost theological talk, but I'm really glad that she was able to give us a new definition of pioneer. So now we will have a few minutes that we can hear from some of you. And I hope that you'll come up here and bear your vagina testimony to us. As I said before, men are welcome. And please share with us what you have in your heart.
Hi, I'm really glad for this opportunity. The first time I sketched a nude woman, the days before, I was very, very, very nervous. I didn't know where I was going to look. I didn't know if it was going to be okay. And got into the studio, and it was okay from the very, very first moment. And it was nice to be able to look at the pubic hair and to look at the breasts, all the places that we were not supposed to look, and we were supposed to look at eyes. And that was a great experience. Then as I got into art school and had more and more opportunities to draw bodies, the first time I drew a male nude was even... it wasn't more. It was as wonderful to be able to draw penises, to look at the sack, to look at different parts of the body that and to look at it as a whole. And then I decided that I, for my own body's sake and for other reasons, to get involved with naturism and have the opportunity to just be on a hike someplace by myself and say, I'm tired of these clothes, get these off, and to rip them off. And then to have chances to go on free hikes and to be in other situations where there was nudity and there were thin bodies and large bodies and older bodies and younger bodies and male bodies, and to be able to look at penises and look at breasts and look at vaginas and to talk about them. And I contrast that, then I think about the old story of giving talks in church, that if you were nervous to look at the audience and picture them nude, and somehow that would give you the feeling of humor and you'd be able to get through your talk. Now when I go to church, I picture everybody nude and I feel an ache because I just imagine that a good majority of them feel either nothing about their bodies or problems about their bodies. And I'm coming to know my body a little bit better and accept it as it is and its age and its sex and its femininity. And I'm glad for this opportunity to talk about sexuality and to talk about bodies. And I'm glad for the times that I have to feel good about mine. And I wish that there were a greater forum to talk about body images and sexuality. And here it is. And that's my testimony.
You know you want to.
Oh, okay, so I'm pregnant.
And if this baby were anything like my other two babies, then she would be here by now, but she's giving me a little bit more time, and so I've been in this space for a while now, just trying to, I've done this twice before, but trying to, like, figure out the mechanics again of how this goes from the inside to the outside. And hearing a lot of this discussion, it's brought that back to the surface for me, because I've realized in the last several weeks that it's not just a religious institution that wants to separate us from our bodies. It's also a medical institution that wants to separate women from their bodies. And as I've been reading and rereading a lot of the literature on natural birth and all that that entails, it's so interesting that it's not intuitive, that I really have to get into this space of, like, okay, I need to forget everything I've ever been told about my body, sexually, reproductively, in giving birth and expelling this baby from my body. I need to just forget all of it. And I need to embrace that I am enough, that I can do it, that I'm not broken, that I don't need somebody else to tell me how, that I don't need a doctor with a big, huge light in between my legs to tell me if I'm too big or too small or too this or too that, that I can do it, that I can get inside of myself, that I can be so at one with this amazing power that I have within myself, and I can get this baby out. And I think that that's, for me, my focus right now isn't in my sexual self, it's in my creative self. And so I'm so grateful to be hearing and to be surrounded by this really female energy, to be reminded again in this really great way that we're all enough. Whatever our focus is, if it's sexual, if it's reproductive, if it's creative, whatever it is right now, we're all enough. And that's it.
Haven't burned my testimony in a while. But I wanted to talk about a story that involves vaginas and telling the truth. And it started about 2.5 years ago when I had not yet learned how to let my vagina tell the truth about what it did and didn't want. And I met a man who knew a lot about what he wanted, but not a lot about what I wanted. And I got pregnant. And after I got pregnant, I learned a lot about trying to say that I didn't actually want the baby that I was supposed to have, and learning about the power of having a penis and the power to tell a woman what she should do with her vagina and the womb that goes with that vagina. And I learned that it's hard to say no to that too. And so I agreed to have a baby. And then I learned a couple weeks after I made that decision, once again, the power of a person with a penis to walk away from that situation, and the requirement of the person with the womb to stay in that situation and be responsible for something that somebody else refuses to be responsible about. And that's when I started thinking a lot about telling the truth and what it means to tell the truth with your whole being, including your vagina. And I was alone, and I was pregnant, and I was living with my parents in a Mormon neighborhood, and it was really, really hard, and I was very, very angry, and I would think a lot about telling the truth, and what if I had been able to learn earlier, because I knew my body better, how to say no when I wanted to say no, and yes when I wanted to say yes. And I thought that, I decided that I would take the 9 months to not just give birth to a human being that wasn't me, but to give birth to a human being who was me, and to learn how to tell the truth, and to give birth to a person who could tell the truth. And so that's what I did. And I spent 9 months going swimming a lot. And as I swam, I imagined my cervix opening like a flower. And I imagined a baby coming out of it, which in the end was harder than imagining it while you were swimming in a swimming pool. And I also went to these really awesome woo-woo birth classes. And everybody was there with their husbands and holding their husbands' hands and staring into their eyes. And I was there with my brother, and it was great. And we watched videos like how to have an orgasmic birth. And he held my hand, and after the movie would end, everybody would look and imagine the last time they had sex with their partner, and I would be like, this is my brother. Thanks for coming, brother. And so, after a lot of those orgasmic birth classes and a lot of swimming, I was 9 months pregnant and about to have a baby. And I remember saying in that woo-woo birth class where we shared feelings pretty much all the time that I wanted to have an honest birth. And for me, that meant I wanted to know what it would feel like to have that mask, that social mask that I was taught as a woman to have all the time. What it would be like to have that drop away and to just be this primal person who just did who I was, not like was what I was, you know? And I wanted that experience. I was so afraid that I wouldn't have it. And so I planned all these little ceremonies for myself so I could get ready. But one day I woke up and I was about to hang the peacock feathers that are the requirement of a woo-woo room preparation for birth. And my water broke and I didn't have time to do anything like that. It was like a little house on the prairie moment at my house. People heating up water to put in the birth tub. Everybody having their role and people shouting from the porch, she's having her baby! So I had my baby, but I'd assigned everybody in my family, well, they'd chosen roles, and my 14-year-old brother, who was uniquely changed by the experience, had said that he wanted to, you know, provide food and help people feel comfortable, but 5 minutes in, he was out the door, because he really felt like playing tennis, but the rest of my family was there, and I had a baby, and it was in the middle of it. It was the most amazing thing. I went from this head person that I'd always been into this body person that I'd so rarely been, and I was just like riding around and moving my body, and it was the most amazing experience. And I remember one point in the birth, I looked at my mom and I said something that was my deepest fear. I said, what if I rip in half? And she said, you won't rip in half. And that was most, and then it just dropped, and that was the most honest experience that I've ever had. And I felt like I learned to tell the truth through that experience and have a baby who I hope could be as honest in the world as I had tried to learn to be in the 9 months getting ready to give birth to her. And I named her Scout because I wanted her to be a pioneer in this world of what it means to be a strong woman. And but I wasn't done because I thought, oh, great, I learned to give birth to a new self, but I still want to learn to have a vagina that knows how to say yes to what it wants. And then 9 months later, ironically, after like my own personal regestation of myself, to continue this elaborate metaphor, I met this amazing woman and I fell in love with her. And it was the first time I'd had sex with a woman. And I realized in this moment, like, this was finally it for me. All those moments in the swimming pool, swimming around and trying to figure out how to be honest. I'm not saying that having sex with a woman makes you automatically honest, otherwise there would be a lot more honest people in this world. But I am saying that when I had that experience, I realized that without a penis that was just supposed to go inside me and someone who was supposed to get what they want and then leave, it was twice as hard to be dishonest about what I wanted. And so I learned to have the awesomest, queerest, most amazing sex ever, and I learned to have a vagina that said yes to a baby and yes to itself. And I wasn't going to share that story because, to use the old excuse, I had a headache, but but I'm really glad for this amazing group of people who promote honesty, so thanks.
One more.
So this is my first experience with Sunstone. And my first experience with anything like the vagina monologues when I was down at Southern Utah University. They had the vagina monologues on campus, I believe it was 2010. And one of my roommates, who was super liberal, and at the time I was super conservative, I'm not that way anymore, said, "Oh, we need to go to this." And I just looked at her and I was like, "Are you nuts?" I was like, I never said the word, well, I probably did, but I really never said the word vagina. Now I say it to the point where it's probably a little obnoxious. But with what, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but with you being saying we need to be honest, from the point when I joined the LDS Church, I was actually Catholic, very Catholic, and then joining the LDS Church and then coming out as a lesbian, all in the space of 3 years, and coming from being super conservative in a very Midwest, grew up on a farm, super conservative, to being pretty liberal, all in 3 years, a lot of things changed. And coming from a place of growing up Catholic and having that sexual, I don't even know what to call it. I mean, it's very repressed. There is no such thing as birth control. When my mom had my youngest brother, her fifth child, she had to have a hysterectomy, like medically needed, or I mean, she could have died. And she went through this fit because that, in her eyes, was a form of birth control because there were not going to be any more children. And when I was growing up and just hormones were raging and everything was unbalanced, they put me on birth control to help stabilize it. And my mom and I threw a fit because it is birth control, whether it's being used in that way or not. And then joining the LDS Church and having this faith, I love the church, but also knowing that I want no one with a penis anywhere near me. There needs to be room for the Holy Ghost, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But coming out as a lesbian and being able to say, like, I have a vagina and I like them a lot. I love women, but I am still a very faith-centered person. My girlfriend and I are very faith-centered people. She served a mission. I almost served a mission. We have this huge sense of faith, and it's huge in our relationship, that is a very important thing to both of us. And being very honest when we're being intimate, it is are you okay with this? Is this okay? Does this feel good? Does this not feel good? With other experiences in my life, that is a huge, very important for me that my partner is aware of that. Are you okay with this? Does this feel good? And it has opened up a whole new, this whole new thing about my life and where it goes with me being a woman and embracing my sexuality and embracing everything that it means to be a woman and to be a righteous and spiritual daughter of God. And I genuinely believe that I am that. Regardless of me being a lesbian, I am still loved and cherished by my Heavenly Father, and it's a huge thing for me. But I have grown to embrace my body. When for so long, because I knew that I was a lesbian but didn't really want to come out and say it, I was terrified to talk about anything in a sexual sense at all because someone would find out. Someone would know, and I didn't want that. And now I don't care. Now I will shout it from the rooftops. I will tell anybody who wants to know. Vagina is one of my favorite words now, it seems like. So, I don't know. It's been a huge thing. I'm really glad that my friend Ellen had told me about this session before Sunstone started, because I don't know if I would have come in on my own. I don't know if I would have done this, but I'm really glad that I did. All the panelists were great. I'm really glad that I was able to do this. I say this in the name of Jesus Christ and everything else that is important in our lives. Amen.
I love this thing. It goes up, it comes down just as we need it to. My life has been an experience of extremes. I've spent time as a John Bircher, this is true confessions, and I spent time being a raging liberal. I'm definitely on the side of liberal now, but I'm nothing like I was raised to be. I grew up in Provo. My father taught chemistry at BYU for 40 years. And it was a very traditional Mormon household. In one of those pendulum swings that I experienced, I asked my mother in my late teens if she'd ever had an orgasm. I figured that by then she'd figured out at least what sex was because she'd had 8 kids. She said to me, I think I might have had one once. That was kind of what I suspected was the case. I think repression isn't anywhere near strong enough a word for what we experienced in that culture. I wasn't even supposed to have a body, let alone a mind, as a female. I was just simply a vessel of some sort. One of the things that I finally realized is it wasn't just the patriarchy in my life that taught me that it was the matriarchy, too, that taught me that. There weren't any women who taught young women's. It was only women who taught me that I was a piece of chewed gum if I had any sexual experience. And nobody would ever want to chew me again if I'd already been chewed. That I was a piece of buttered toast and disgusting once that butter was licked off. I'm sure most of you have been taught about your sexuality or your virginity, as the case may be, with similar kinds of metaphors. I think my favorite, though, is still the rose. It was a really popular one in the ward that I grew up in. And clearly the women thought it was brilliant because I saw it done again and again. I think in every single damn one of my young women's classes, I got to see some version of this. The rose, you're familiar with this. It's a beautiful rose, and we're supposed to admire the rose, right? And then the teacher has us pass it around. And if it doesn't get back mangled enough, then it gets passed around again. And then, of course, by the time we've been told to smell it, fondle it, mess around with it sufficiently, then she'll offer it to one of the girls and ask her, do you want to take this home and have this be your own personal rose? Well, of course, nobody wants it then. We all got the message, right? We got it the first time. That my sexuality is somebody else's own damn frosting, own damn rose. This is my rose. It's nobody else's. And I had to reshape my thinking after going through years of hating the patriarch and thinking that I hated those bastards so much I was going to be a lesbian. I had to realize that actually maybe the whole system is messed up. This whole attitude of us versus them, this whole attitude about what makes us okay, what doesn't make us okay. We're beautiful just as we are. And we do all kinds of sick and disgusting and stupid and repressive things to ourselves to make ourselves not be okay so that then somehow we can thereby be made okay with our not okayness. I think God is fine with us as we are. I really liked what Dominique, is it, said about God doesn't make something that isn't perfect. I think the problem is in our definition of perfection. I think we feel somehow that perfection is somewhere where we need to arrive by lopping off parts of our essential selves. And if we get skinny enough, if we get less of ourselves enough, then somehow we will arrive at perfect. And I think that is so stupid. I think that kind of thinking is so seriously fucked up. I want us to now spend the rest of our lives reclaiming those perfect parts of ourselves that we gave up in our quest to become perfect. I am very proud to be here today with my two daughters, both of whom I love dearly, and both of whom are the products of my own sexuality, and I'm proud that they are. And they are perfect, and they're beautiful. So thank you. I love you.
Thank you so much, everyone. Appreciate you, everyone who came to listen to us.